And so to get started, can you just tell us a little bit about who Jim is and what you do?
Well, I do as little as possible now. Well, not exactly. So who am I?
Who are you and what do you do?
All right. So my name's Jim Gerrish. I'm old now, but I was at the University of Missouri for 23, actually 20, 22 years, 3 months. Worked in pasture and grazing research at the University of Missouri's Forage Systems Research Center up in Linn County. Most of the time while we were in Missouri, we had our own personal grass farm, also 260 acres. Initially, when we had a smaller acreage, ran just sheep. And then as we bought more land, we added cattle. And so we did cow, calf, stockers, a little bit of pasture finishing. We did both at the University Research Center and our own farm, did get to the point where we grazed cattle through the entire winter. We might feed, 2, 3, 5 days of hay in an ice storm or something. And then, 2004, we moved to Idaho. Did not necessarily, the move to Idaho was recreational lifestyle move. Didn't really expect to be involved in ranching again, but I fell into a deal managing 400. It was a, one unit of a larger ranch. We had 450 center pivot acres that we grazed, and then several hundred acres of native rangeland. And we were a seasonal unit. We were a higher elevation than headquarters ranch. So we did not keep cattle up there year round. Usually we would graze into December or January, and then we'd send them back down to the main ranch and get pairs back up again in the spring. I've written the book you're probably most interested in and familiar with is Kick the Hay Habit. I wrote the Management Intensive Grazing book first, then Kick the Hay Habit. I've done a couple others since, but I have spent a lot of my research career and grazing practice working on year-round grazing scenarios. So that's who I am, and that's what I do.
Awesome. So you're the perfect person to talk to whenever we're discussing this concept of 365 days of grazing. So when you hear that, if a producer was to come to you and say, "Hey, I'm ready to do this year round," how would you tell them to start?
Okay, there's some real key points that make it easier to do. And this all ties to the overall profitability of ranching. And one of the biggest impediments to profitable ranching is people calving in the wintertime because that elevates feed costs. Now, if you're in the deep south, it's less of an issue. But if we think of the, I'd say basically anything north of Interstate 40, just moving across the whole country, north of Interstate 40, winter feed costs are typically the largest single item in the cow-calf operation budget. And so what makes feed costs the highest thing is calving in wintertime, because the nutritional demand of the cow, of course, is cyclic through the year, and it's based on when the calf is born, how long it takes to get peak lactation. What is the milking ability of that cow? And if you calve in the winter, you do end up having your highest feed demand occurring in months that typically you don't have green growing grass. And so people are feeding harvested feed, and very often we see a day of hay feeding costing more, as much, or more than twice as much, I should say. So Feeding hay is almost always double the cost of grazing, and sometimes it's even greater. So the first key to year-round grazing is actually, what we would call stock policy, and that is the type of livestock you have on the place, the number of livestock, when we talk a lot about having a flexible stocking rate, variable stocking rate, so you're not same number of animals year round. And so first step to being able to implement year-round grazing is usually getting your calving season. And I usually don't say in sync with nature, I say in sync with your forage supply. And the years that I spent in Missouri, a big part of our feed supply was fescue. And I always say there's five good reasons for growing tall fescue: November, December, January, February, and March. It can be a terrible grass in the summertime, but in those winter months of stockpile feed, it's typically less toxic. It's good nutrition, and we ran fall calving cows through the entire winter on nothing but stockpiled pasture and, then salt and mineral supplement. So if you are particularly in an area where fescue is your dominant base forage, fall calving actually makes sense because when the animals have their highest nutritional demand, so that's birthing, lactation, rebreeding. If you can get that accomplished in the winter months and stockpiled fescue, fall calving makes perfect sense. So that is not at all calving in sync with nature. That is calving in sync with your forage supply. There are, farmers, mixed crop and livestock farmers who have corn stalk fields that they want to utilize. And if you have corn stalks and a little bit of grass to go with it, in a situation like that, fall calving can make sense. Again, it's not calving in sync with nature, it's calving in sync with your forage supply. So that's the number one step, is get your calving season right. Number two, because I say we need to have a variable stocking rate, different animal demand, different forage demand through the season as our supply fluctuates. The other part of stock policy is, okay, if you are going to run something besides cow-calf, what are those enterprises going to be? When are you going to bring animals in? one of the things that was a real game changer for me back in Missouri was when I realized if you want to graze year-round, and cow-calf was our centerpiece enterprise. And for most Missouri cattle producers, I'm pretty sure cow-calf is still the primary enterprise. Yeah, there's feed. Some people have gone strictly to stockers. Some, have cow-calf and yearlings. Some people have added sheep to it. Some people do this. Some people do that. But when we figured that you set your cow herd size based on your winter grazing capacity, not your summer grazing capacity, that makes it also a lot easier, because if you set your cow herd size based on what you can carry in the summer months, that guarantees that you're going to have excess forage in the spring that you're going to cut for hay. And at the end of the summer, you're not going to have any grass left in the field. And so you got to feed all that hay. And so if we can figure out what can we reasonably expect year in, year out, how many cows can we graze through the winter and have that as our base herd size, then any excess grass that we have in the spring, we can harvest with some other class of livestock coming in. So we got into custom grazing. Let's see. Probably about 1993. So it was about 10 years into our grass farming operation that we started doing custom grazing. And then for the next 10 years, that's how we balanced out our forage supply and demand. Now, you say custom grazing, and a lot of people automatically assume, oh, you mean steers, stockers. And that's where we started. And they turned out to be my least favorite animal. We custom grazed replacement heifers for people, cow-calf pairs, dry fall calving cows for corn farmers. And the dry fall calving cow was my favorite animal to custom graze because it takes no management to make a dry cow fat. And that was charged by the head day rather on a rate of gain basis. So we knew what the paycheck was going to be. We got half the money when the cows arrived, the other half when they shipped out. So that was a custom grazing operation that matched up real well with our objectives. I know some beef producers who actually custom graze dry dairy cows or dairy replacement heifers, particularly for grazing dairies, because grass-based dairies realize pretty quickly that all their money is made from milking cows on grass. Every bite of feed that a replacement heifer or a dry cow consumes is feed being taken away from the milking stream. And so there's opportunities in the beef industry to custom graze for dairy people, stuff like that. And then the final point that we get to, and it's not really the final point, but the third big thing is you have to be managing from the first blade of green grass in the spring, you have to be managing with the objective of having X amount of pasture acres left stockpiled at the end of your growing season. So the three key points are: don't calve in the wintertime, calve in sync with your forage supply. Have the appropriate classes of livestock on the place to utilize the forage supplies that you have. And then every day of the growing season, you are working towards creating feed available in the dormant season. And so there's kind of the foundation of it, and you probably have a few questions.
Yeah, no, those all seem like great points. And one of the questions I did have was kind of in respect to, ranchers who have five head of cattle to folks who have 500 or 5,000 head that, they're working with. It sounds like a lot of those points would apply regardless of size.
Exactly. So when we were in Missouri, we usually had about 60 cows of our own. Now, we might, if we were custom grazing pairs that year, about 60 more pairs is what we would bring in, but we'd only have them for about 4 months, for maybe 5 months. So that's the scale we worked on in Missouri. When I came out to Idaho, we generally ran 400 to 500 pairs on our unit. And to me, it's almost easier to run the 500 than it is, 50. And when you're grazing in the wintertime, moving us, and so we would move electric fences typically every day, sometimes every 3 days, but typically I was still moving fences every day in the wintertime. And it essentially takes the same amount of time to move the fence for 500 if you have your basic infrastructure set up right. Takes the same amount of time to move the fence for 500 cows as it does for 50 cows. You look at that in contrast to feeding hay. If you're hauling hay and taking it out there, 500 cows, you're taking 10 times the volume of hay, every day feeding it out to the cows. So obviously, it's much more labor efficient grazing cows in the wintertime. Because I mean, let's you can get like the mechanical bale feeders that you put six bales on, and they're going to, in big squares, flake it off. On rounds, you might have like a mix, a TMR that you can put a couple of bales in and process it out. But basically, any way to increase the efficiency at which you feed hay to a cow herd, every increment you move up costs you more and more money and equipment to do that. It takes no more equipment and no more time to graze 500 cows than it does 50 cows. Takes a lot
Yeah.
longer to feed them hay, though.
Yeah. So when you're talking about, we're early on in the year now, but we're already thinking about not only how to get through what's left of this winter, but also how to be prepared for next winter. And kind of back to your third point, how do ranchers and grass farmers sit and kind of make that plan? Is that literally a pen and paper? Is there a formula to use? How do you recommend they set themselves up for success throughout the year?
Okay, good question. Yeah, occasionally I still use a pen and paper, but almost all my grazing planning is done on the computer. For years, I ran just spreadsheets that I had created, that I could generate feed projections and usage rates and all that. And that worked fine, but I'm a real spreadsheet geek. There are various grazing management software programs, Maya Grazing from Australia, PastureMap, AgriWeb. Those are tools that a grazer can use to streamline that planning process. And of those, I think Maya Grazing is the most useful of those three tools. And there's other new programs out, that I'm not familiar with. But the thing with any of those software packages, they are, fee-based. There's a subs you purchase it, there's a subscription, and usually it is tied to the number of animal units you're running. And there's a sliding scale. The more animal units you're running, the lower the software cost per animal unit is going to be. But there is the companies, they do have to have a threshold level that this, if you've got fewer, and I'm just going to say 50 cows, I'm not sure where the number is, but if you have, anything from 10 to 50 cows, you're paying the very base rate. And so obviously the person who just has 10 cows is at a real disadvantage financially trying to use a plan like that. But you know what? It's pretty easy to just work the numbers around 10 cows. So yeah, just do a spreadsheet and plan it that way. But as you get to larger and larger herd size, the economic efficiencies of the software, the grazing management, herd management softwares, they all get more user friendly and cost friendly at a larger scale operation. But but basically what you have to understand is what, that cyclic demand curve that the cow has. What is she consuming as a dry pregnant cow? What does she need to be consuming the last month of gestation? What's that going to increase to as she comes to peak lactation? How long is she going to be at peak lactation? What's the rate of decline in feed? And then superimposed on that is, the calf at basically at 90 days of age, the calf's transitions from being milk dependent to being forage dependent. That's just hypothetically, day 90, the calf is getting 50% of its nutrition from milk and 50% from forage. from day 1 to 90, it's milk predominant. Day 90 to whenever weaning is, it's forage dominant. So we have to factor in. I usually don't even factor the calf in until it's after 3 months of age. And then after 3 months of age, we have to start factoring in what the calf is going to eat. And so this is also where it becomes very important having these pasture records, the grazing records. Because in a program like Maya Grazing, it's going to take what your historic grazing yields have been and project that into the future. And that's how you work out the supply and demand equation. We, you know, for when both in, well, here in Idaho, I did bi-weekly pasture inventory. So every 2 weeks, I went across all of our pastures and on a unit by unit basis, estimated, just visually estimated, how much feed we had in the field. And the last, if you do that, the last inventory of the season, of the growing season that you take, that defines what your feed supply is going to be for the winter. And if you want to graze through the entire winter, you got to look at then your herd inventory, calculate what the demand for that herd is going to be. And if that herd demand is exceeding what your forage availability, your inventory, your pasture inventory says you have, you need to make an adjustment in numbers. And the people who do this seriously, that's when they're going to decide, okay, I'm going to call 7%, you know, more cows. And that typically is what I call luxury culling, because that's the opportunity. You know, we have cows that at the time, you know, they have a calf on them and they're raising the calf, said, man, she ain't very good. And so you mark her down to cull for just poor performance. You know, half her udder might be bad. You mark those down. Luxury culling is when you take the oldest cows. They might still be good cows, but you take the oldest cows out. You take ones that you just don't quite like because they give you the hairy eyeball every time you come around them. And so if that is a good time to make those kind of culling decisions, because a lot of times people don't cull those animals because they think they have to keep their numbers up, and they end up expensive hay feeding through the winter on a cow that just isn't really delivering what you expect your, you know, all the other cows are doing. And so it puts pressure on you to manage the herd more effectively. And what most people, you know, that I've consulted with and worked with over the years, where they end up is realizing that having that pasture inventory and knowing what their feed supply is going to be made them much more aggressive in their culling. And, you know, 5 years, 10 years into it, they said, man, I got a lot better herd than I did before, simply because planning the number of cows that they could carry through the winter forced them to, you know, cut more dead wood out of the herd. And I've yet to meet a herd that doesn't have dead wood in it.
Yeah. So is there a particular time of year that you would say it's best to sit down and have these conversations or start this plan, or is it sooner the better?
Okay. So the way we structured our stock policy, our herd in Missouri, we knew that we needed to begin stockpiling feed for the cow herd around August 1st, August 1st to 15th. As you move, we were in North Missouri, we were in Linn County. As you move further south down through Missouri, and I know you've got a broader readership than just Missouri, but it's a good point of reference because up where we were, it was more like Iowa. Down at you know, Mount Vernon or West Plains, it's more like Arkansas. And there's a big difference. So when I talk about moving from North Missouri down to South Missouri and how things might change. That's really just a micro picture of the whole center swath of the country.
Right.
All right. So we generally wanted to begin stockpiling pastures between August 1st and August 15th. In South Missouri, it might be September 30th to October 15th. There's about that much difference. And so we set up our custom grazing to ensure that whatever livestock we were grazing, that we had brought in extra livestock, they had to leave our place by August 1st and at the very latest by the 15th. The first few years that we did custom grazing, I did not have written contracts. It was handshake deal. And the guy said, oh, yeah, I can have them out of there by August 1st, but, well, I can't get trucks this week. Oh, I don't have space in the feedlot. I don't have this. And it's the middle of September, and you still got those animals there. And they've eaten up all of what you were trying to stockpile. So it's very important that if you are either buying in additional livestock or you're custom grazing to utilize the spring flush, you got to have them out of there by a particular date to ensure that you can grow that added feed. So the back to your question of when do you need to have the conversations to plan this, really, it starts before the spring grass, because you're talking to the cattle owner that you're planning on custom grazing for, and you've got to be you the grazer and the cattle owner need to be in agreement that yes, we can have them out of here by August 1st. And then we also eventually we got to the point where we wrote the drought contingency in there also, that and we would give the cattle owner 30 days notice, you know, that was in the contract. If we need to end the grazing season earlier than the August 1st target date, you will have at least 30 days notice. And the biweekly pasture inventory that I was doing, you know, I knew exactly how much feed I had. And if you do this for several years and you have a historic record of what's gone on your farm across the seasons, you can see whether you're trending above average, you're at average, or you're below average. And if you're trending, you know, below average on the 4th of July, you better have a plan to be reducing animal numbers even ahead of that August date there. So yeah, there is planning, there is management involved. If you're willing to do it, there's great financial benefit and land management benefit that comes from that planning.
Do you know of any resources as far as, you know, whether it's conservation type or through the extension or FSA, USDA, all the programs that are out there for farmers and ranchers? Are there any that, you know, specifically help grazers?
I'm not sure I understand the question. There are a lot of resources out there.
Mm-hmm.
Some are better than others. You know, I've got books on this topic. So I cheerfully encourage you to encourage your, you know, readers to visit our website and look at those resources. NRCS in some states have very, very good grazing management resources geared towards year-round grazing. In some states, they do not. In some states, University Extension has very good information on winter grazing, planning for it. University of Missouri is one of those. At least when I left 20 years ago, they had good information, and I think they still have been advancing on it. Missouri, in the 80s and 90s, Missouri was way, way ahead of most states on grazing management research, grazing education, all of those things. So it does depend to an extent what state you live in whether the University Extension and whether NRCS, have good quality information.
Okay, yeah, that answers my question, so thanks. In the years that you've been doing this, I'm sure you've talked to more than a few ranchers. Have you been met with any common misconceptions of people saying, well, this won't work for our operation because, or kind of excuses why people won't adopt it that you can kind of disprove?
Absolutely. The Allen Nation, I don't know if he was the first person who said it, but he was one who I first heard say, most people would rather fail conventionally than succeed unconventionally. Part of the reason I left the university is I came to the realization, I actually had, for the most of the time I was in Missouri, I had 100% research appointment. Now, I was one of the three people who co-founded and started the whole grazing school program in Missouri. Zero extension appointment when I did that, 100% research. I probably ended up doing, from a time standpoint, 30 to 40% extension work the last several years I was in Missouri. What I realized is farmers and ranchers usually don't base their decisions on adopting a new practice based on economic reality, biological reality. It is based almost entirely on their social network. What will my family think? What will my family say? What will my neighbors say? And so I realized we do not need to be creating new knowledge. We need to get people to implement what we already know. And as I got further and further and further into this, it's implementing stuff that we've known for 100, 200 or more years in grazing management. What is the most effective way of doing it? But, well, that might work where you are, but that won't work here. I've heard that too many times to count. And then the people who say, well, I tried that and it didn't work. And, you kind of press them of what they tried and they didn't really try anything of consequence. I'll be 69 next month. And I'm just kind of tired of the lack of progress, the slow rate of progress that we have made in this field. 25 years ago, I thought that 40 to 50% of the beef produced and consumed in the U.S. was going to be grass-fed beef, because if you do it at scale, it's a much more cheaper production method than what the feedlot is, both economic cost and environmental cost. I figured at least half of ranchers would be doing some kind of grazing management, moving cattle, at least once a week, 25%, doing 1 to 3 day moves. And we've barely broke 10% on any of those things. And it is back to most people would rather fail conventionally than succeed unconventionally. It's easier to get a job in town than it is to use your head and doing something sensible on your own property. It's just easier.
Yep, I like that quote. So kind of as a wrap up, do you have any final thoughts or words of encouragement for ranchers who are willing to try this and who maybe just need a little last bit of encouragement to get them started?
A lot of people have made this piece of progress. And the very first step to improving the profitability of most cow-calf operations is don't calve in the winter. Do it on green grass.
Yep. Seems.
That's the biggest thing. And if once you make that change and realize the benefits there, then people are generally more open-minded to ideas on how to more effectively manage their grazing and extend the grazing season well beyond what the growing season actually is. Calving in winter just locks you into having to have stored feed to meet that increased demand occurring at that time of year.
Yeah. Well, it sounds pretty simple when you put it like that.
Do you know who Tom Lasseter was?
I'm familiar with the name.
Okay, so he was the founder of the Beefmaster breed. And I think Tom Lasseter's most famous quote is, profitable ranching is very simple. Keeping its, oh, damn it. I forgot exactly what it, but essentially it's ranching is really simple. The challenge is keeping it simple. And that's the gist of it. We make it a whole lot more complicated than it needs to be. Now, I talked about record keeping and planning, and yeah, some of that's kind of complicated, but it isn't a complicated production and management system. It doesn't depend on a lot of purchased inputs and equipment and fertilizer and all that. It depends on thinking and planning.
Yeah, I've heard a lot lately that there's a difference between simple and easy. And
Oh, yeah.
I kind of feel like that kind of goes along. It seems simple, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be easy.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, well, thank you, Jim, so much for your time and your contributions. I learned a lot today. I know our readers and listeners will too. So,
Great.
appreciate you being here.